Hey, this is Rick Cassells from ExercisesForInjuries.com. Today I have another interview for you, and it's kind of focusing on the nutrition side. So it's not specifically on, you know, the injuries or injuries in exercise. We're going to kind of chat a little bit more when it comes to the nutrition side. So today I have Brian, and Brian, I'll get you to introduce yourself to the listeners and give them a little bit of an idea of your background.
Sure. Well, like I said, I'm Brian. I'm Brian St. Pierre. I got my, you know, my bachelor's degree in human nutrition and dietetics from the University of Maine. And then I actually was the first intern ever at Cressy Performance and became the first and only employee for quite a long time. And then I went back to UMaine for my master's in human nutrition and also to do a dietetic internship to become a registered dietitian. I'm also the author of the Show and Go Nutrition Guide for Eric Cressy's Show and Go training system, and the author of the Ultimate Hockey Training Nutrition Guide for Kevin Neal's Ultimate Hockey Training. I work with clients online and training and nutrition, and that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Okay. And you're going to school right now. What are you focusing your studies on?
Well, right now at the exact moment, I'm wrapping up my 7-month-long dietetic internship, which is mostly in a hospital setting, though you do some, you know, community work and some like food service kind of stuff, food service management. You know, really it's much more of a clinical focus than what I normally do. But it's been good. You know, it's kind of filled in areas of knowledge that I wasn't really working on before. You know, I never really worked in a hospital setting before, so it's a different area, different kind of goals. You know, you're working on people who are acutely ill rather than people who are just trying to get healthier or, you know, prevent illness.
Or improving performance. Yeah, definitely.
Right.
Different population. Okay, so I put up on Facebook and asked people what they'd like me to ask you about. And one thing that kind of came up, a few questions kind of relating to it when it comes to, like, nutritional frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So any thoughts when it comes to, yeah, when people should consume things?
Sure. You know, there's certainly a lot of dogma out there, you know, eating every 2 to 3 hours, eating 6 to 8 times a day, and it just starts to dominate your life. And, I mean, that works for some people. Some people enjoy it. They like having small, frequent meals. It keeps them from getting overly hungry and eating too much. But for a lot of people, it's, you know, it's kind of a pain. You feel like all you're ever doing is making meals and packing meals and eating meals and cleaning up after meals. And so the research doesn't actually really support that. Really what it shows is it doesn't make a huge difference either way, whether it's 6 or 3 or 4. You know, it's really about what works for your schedule, you know, what works for your family life, for your work life, and to help you reach your goals. If you need to consume, you know, a Michael Phelps-esque 14,000 calories a day, you might have to consume 6 or 8 meals in order to get that number. But if you only are consuming, you know, 1,600, 2,000 calories a day, well, 3 or 4 meals might be an easier way to do that and at least provide you with a satisfying meal. So it kind of depends on the person, on their goals, and on their, you know, on their life schedule, I guess is my answer.
Okay. And then another question that kind of came up was, you know, proper timing of supplements throughout the day and what to eat or avoid when taking them that aid or deter their absorption.
Sure. In terms of supplements, I think it's best to take them whenever you're most likely to take them. You know, there isn't a ton of data to support nutrient timing, really, in the overall grand scheme of things. So I don't think necessarily the timing matters so much as just being consistent. You know, if you consistently get it in the morning, then consistently take it in the morning. So, you know, that's kind of the key there, regardless of what the supplement may be. You know, you can obviously fit in protein powders in different times, things of that nature. But a general, you know, multivitamins and vitamin D and fish oil, you know, whatever works best for you is really the best time to take it. And in terms of things that might, you know, inhibit or, you know, alter absorption, you know, definitely be aware of meds. If you're on any type of medication, it's really important to discuss possible interactions with your doctor. Even if, you don't love discussing supplements with your doctor, it's still important because meds can certainly be affected by supplements. You know, things like something as simple as grapefruit can really alter the absorption or the utilization of some certain medications, so you want to make sure you discuss stuff like that. You know, then in terms of competing with each other, certain minerals, you know, magnesium, copper, iron, zinc, they all kind of compete for the same stuff to a degree. Things like green tea, like the tannins in tea, can kind of prevent the absorption of some things, specifically like iron. You know, so stuff like that you can maybe keep in mind if you're taking a supplemental calcium, that's important to know. If you're taking a supplemental magnesium, or if you're anemic and you're taking iron, you know, those kind of things are important. But for the general population who's just taking it for general health purposes, there isn't a ton to keep in mind unless you're on a pharmaceutical medication.
Okay. Okay. And then maybe expanding a little bit on the timing thing. So really there isn't really much research showing, you know, eating a late breakfast or eating an early breakfast or a late dinner, an evening dinner, really doesn't have much effect when it comes to, you know, weight loss or fat loss.
Not specifically, no. I mean, the research in the grand scheme of things, you know, in the big picture, really shows that total intake will dictate your results, regardless of whether you, you know, eat it all at night or eat it all in the morning. I mean, look at people who do intermittent fasting, for example, and don't eat all morning and then eat all their calories afternoon. You know, they eat late into the night to get in their calorie allotment, and they're getting fantastic results. So timing, you know, is not nearly as important. It's a far secondary piece to total intake.
Okay. Then maybe you can, I mean, I've heard more and more about this intermittent fasting. It seems to have been, kind of a small number of people were doing it. Now it's become more and more mainstream. So maybe you can kind of explain a little bit more about what intermittent fasting is.
Sure. I mean, I will say I do not claim to be an expert in intermittent fasting. It's something, you know, I have a maybe a little more than a cursory knowledge of, but, you know, certainly not in the realm of some of the people who deal with it day in and day out. But in general, you know, intermittent fasting is using different techniques to fast throughout the week. People might do things where they fast from, you know, 8 p.m. at night, and they'll fast for 16 hours, so they won't eat again until noon the next day, you know, something along those lines. Or maybe they'll do 2 24-hour fasts a week, you know, on Monday and Thursday. There are a lot of different setups people can use. John Berardi actually just wrote a great piece on his experiments with it on his website on Precision Nutrition that I thought was really, really eye-opening. He showed a lot of different methods that people use, and he kind of tried them all and gave his feedback. And so it's really just a way to practice fasting, you know, intermittently, as simple as that sounds, just throughout the week trying different techniques to, I don't want to say restrict food intake, but you are restricting it for certain periods of time, that overall your food intake ends up being less, and to kind of help facilitate fat loss or keep you lean. Some people will actually use it to gain muscle while staying lean, you know, things of that nature.
Okay.
So it kind of came about, like you said, it was kind of a small niche thing, and then I think the paleo movement kind of really helped kick it into higher gear. And it's interesting. A lot of people do seem to have success with it. You know, some people more so than others, but I've had some clients who started off with me who were doing it, and I didn't stop them. It was working for them. It fit their schedule. You know, we just tweaked some food choices and things like that, but it certainly can be very effective if you find it to fit in your lifestyle.
Okay. And then expanding a little bit more about the intermittent fasting, a question that came in was, like, what happens to the body, you know, inside the body during lengths of intermittent fasting, so like 16 hours or 8 hours or 24 hours of intermittent fasting?
Right. You know, it's certainly, again, you know, I'm not a physiology expert to the nth degree, but it's going to be something that's, you know, to keep it simple, you know, essentially your body is going to use up a lot of your glycogen stores. You know, glycogen stored in the muscle and stored in the liver, and they'll use up essentially your brain uses up a huge amount of your glycogen, and it's mainly from your liver. And your body will also use your glycogen and your muscles to function. And so then you will end up creating more glucose from amino acids. Now this is called gluconeogenesis. And so your liver will take some amino acids, generally not from muscle unless you fast for a really long period of time. If you fast for over a day, it starts to kind of deplete, you know, some muscle proteins. But if you're doing a shorter fast, like a 16-hour fast, not really a concern. Your liver will meet its needs from some other amino acids that it's able to recycle. And it'll just kind of create more glucose for the brain to function and to keep your blood sugar levels stable. And obviously you'll also, you know, burn body fat. You know, you'll break down fatty acids and use them for energy along with creating some ketones. So you're kind of, your body is simply relying on interior stores since you're not giving it any exogenous sources.
Okay.
That's kind of break it down.
Okay. And a question that came in was bars. So it's kind of, I guess, common. I mean, what's really been marketed for, protein bars, energy bars, snack bars. So what's kind of the good, bad, and the ugly when it relates to bars?
there's certainly a lot out there. And I like to always point out that protein bars should be used sparingly. You know, they are not a dietary staple, preferably. They're more along the lines of, you know, you got caught in a pinch and you need to get something quick, or you need to run out the door and head off somewhere, you grab a protein bar, and you grab a piece of fruit and some nuts with it or something along those lines, you know, for a quick on-the-go, you know, meal/snack. It shouldn't be, you know, a pre-planned meal per se. You know, we much prefer to see some real food in there. But in terms of things to look for, I mean, there are plenty of bars that are marketed as protein bars that are simply candy bars with some protein added in. You know, they have poor carbohydrate sources, mainly from sugar. They have soy protein as their protein source. They have poor fatty fat sources. You know, there are a lot of those out there. And really what you want to be looking for are things that use whey protein, preferably, as the protein source. Generally, you want minimal ingredients, you know, if they're, or along those same lines, real food ingredients, you know, things that use actual, like, oats as a carbohydrate source, you know, that aren't just using, you know, sugar alcohols, and they're not just using sugar, they're using actual real food sources of things, you know, if possible, or for the most part. There might be a few isolated compounds in there, and that's okay, but generally you want the majority of it to be from real food and to have minimal overall ingredients. You want healthy fats, you know, so things like almond butter or peanut butter or, you know, nuts would be great healthy fat sources. If they're using things like vegetable oil, sunflower oil, generally that's not what we're looking for. You know, so, and again, touching back on the sugar alcohol thing, some sugar alcohols are okay. You can absorb, you can handle some. You don't necessarily absorb sugar alcohols. They end up coming out the other end. And, you know, some is okay, but some bars will have, like, huge amounts, you know, 25 grams of sugar alcohol. For most people, that's not going to sit in the stomach so well. I would definitely steer you clear of that. And in the same vein, you kind of want bars that have a good source of fiber or are a good source of fiber, just to help keep you regular, help getting your fiber content of your diet. And just generally that comes from good sources, things like nuts, things like flax seeds, things like chia seeds. Good companies will put products like that or ingredients like that into their products to increase the fiber content, and that's really actually a good thing. So those are the kind of things we're looking for.
Okay.
Do you look for specific brand recommendations or anything like that?
Well, I mean, that would be my next thing. Is there some that you could kind of say that are on the good side of things?
Sure. There are some bars that I like. I'm sure there are others out there. And in terms of, you know, they also depend on the size you're looking for. You know, like for harder training athletes or people who are looking for, you know, a bigger size bar, I'm a fan of the VPX Zero Impact bars. They have like 30 grams of protein. They're, you know, they get quality fats like from almond butter. They have like actual pumpkin in them. They have rolled oats as a starch source. They're, you know, whey protein. They're quality stuff. They have a fair amount of ingredients, but they're mostly real food ingredients. And they taste pretty good. Clients seem to like them. And so they're, but they're like 440 calories. So generally, women don't tend to gravitate towards those, in speaking in generalities. But it's just a bigger bar that I like. You also have things like J-Bars from the J-Rob company. You know, a smaller bar, about 220 calories. You know, that they have some good flavors. Quest Naturals, Quest Bars, something I actually recently got introduced to by a client. But generally, those are made of Splenda, and I'm not a fan of Splenda. They did just come out with a new line that's sweetened with stevia, and they're called Quest Naturals. I haven't actually tried those flavors yet, but my client assures me that they're excellent. So take that as you will. And then there's also a product called U-Bars, which I'm a fan of, or essentially it's a website, ubars.com. You design your own protein bar. You determine the ingredients. It's all from, like, real food, mostly organic. It's fantastic. They're freshly made and shipped to you. The only downside is they're not cheap. But if you really want a true whole food, real food protein bar, and cost isn't an option or isn't an issue, that's a good way to go.
Cool. I never heard of the U-Bar thing.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
Okay. And then, I mean, can you, is there a bar that you kind of recommend that you would find regularly at the superstore, or at the superstore, at the grocery store?
That's a good question.
Because, I mean, you've listed off those number of bars, and they sound a little bit more like specialty bars that you'd either have to order, or you might have to go to like a Whole Foods or a specialty nutrition store to get. Well, you know,
right.
If you go to the grocery store, it's, you know, Kellogg's and those guys that own the aisle. Is there anything
right.
in there that you'd kind of say that leans on the good side of things?
Off the top of my head, for a brand, you know, I can't say I've really looked closely enough to say, but, you know, I think it comes back to looking at the ingredients like we talked about.
Okay.
You know, what's the protein source? You know, what's the carbohydrate source? Is it loaded with lots of sugar alcohols? Does it have, you know, a vegetable oil as the fat source, or does it have, you know, like a nut or something like that? I think, you know, that's something to kind of look at. In terms of an actual brand, you know, you're right. The stuff I listed is stuff you would end up buying online, but buying online is usually cheaper anyway. So that's the direction I tend to lead people towards. But if you really wanted something, I mean, you'd have to just kind of do some investigating in the ingredients, or feel free to shoot me an email and ask me what I think. I'd be happy to answer people's questions.
Okay. And then one thing that we kind of exchanged over email was coffee. The pros and cons of coffee, which
sure.
I love my coffee in the morning. Yes.
Me too. So, yeah, that's definitely a controversial topic to some people. I mean, in the research, it's actually not very controversial. You know, there is some indication that some people, you know, have basically a genetic component, or I hate to call it a mutation, but it's kind of what it is, where coffee consumption, they tend to metabolize caffeine much more slowly, and it does increase their risk of basically a non-fatal heart attack. But for the majority of the population who is not a slow metabolizer, you know, it'll decrease your risk of Parkinson's, decrease your risk of Alzheimer's, decrease risk of potentially type 2 diabetes. There's quite a long list, you know, some risk, decreased risk of several different types of cancer. But in particular, it's the Alzheimer's one that stands out to me, because there's actually research showing cause and effect, not just a correlation. And they've only published it in mice, but according to the researchers who published it, they have data in humans as well. They're just working on getting it published, showing that, you know, a couple cups, I think it's like 3 cups of coffee per day, 3 8-ounce cups, can decrease risk of Alzheimer's disease in humans. But that's a pretty cheap way to help prevent a very debilitating disease.
Okay. And then how does that translate into Starbucks containers?
Well, Starbucks is maybe a less cheap way to make that happen. You know, I'd recommend brewing home coffee. Definitely save yourself a few pennies that way. And that way you also know, or maybe know a little bit more where the coffee's coming from. You're the one choosing it. But, and most people think, oh, 3 cups. So a lot of people, oh, I'm just having a cup of coffee, and they're having like a 16-ounce cup of coffee. Well, that's according to the research, you know, how the research rates that, is that's 2 cups of coffee. So don't use that as an excuse to get 3 large Dunkin' Donuts a day. You know, it's 3 8-ounce cups, so 24 ounces of coffee, which for most people is generally not a huge intake compared to their usual.
And maybe just kind of, I was thinking about this morning when we were, just before we were going to chat, and it relates kind of to the bars thing. I was having my bowl of cereal, and I was looking at my cereal, and I was thinking, what would Brian say about this cereal? So it kind of relates to the bar question. You know, what's your kind of take on cereal?
Well, what were you having?
I have no idea. It's kind of a mixture of whatever the kids have. I think it was like chocolate Cheerios and Rice Krispies and something else.
So it sounds very mediocre. you know, my take would be cereal's okay. You know, you're not going to get a great amount of protein from cereal. A lot of cereals can be very heavily sweetened with sugar. A lot of cereals that are marketed to kids can be more than half of sugar by weight, which is disgusting. You know, like Apple Jacks. Is it Apple Jacks or no? What was it called?
Frosted.
I don't remember. Dang it. Yeah, well, there's stuff like that. There was recently, and the Environmental Working Group recently did a review of all these cereals that are out there, and specifically ones marketed to kids, and, you know, compared them to basically like having a Twinkie for breakfast. And while there are definitely good cereals out there, there are a lot of ones that are marketed as being kid-friendly. They may not be so great, or even not so great for adults either. So in terms of cereal, again, it comes down to what are the ingredients? Is it mostly like from whole food? You know, Cheerios are a great example. Are they my absolute favorite thing? No, but is it a solid starch option at breakfast? Sure. I mean, it's 100% rolled oats that are essentially made into little circles. You know, you could do a lot worse than a bowl of Cheerios. So you want it to be, you know, minimal ingredients, mostly real food ingredients, you know, and not contain a ton of sugar, have some fiber in there, you know, so things of that nature. And I would also recommend, you know, having a little bit of a protein source and a fruit or vegetable or something along those lines with the cereal as well.
Okay. And then one other topic that you kind of suggested was like environmental factors that can affect one's cancer risk.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely something that, you know, I've been kind of writing about here and there over the past few years. And then I recently came across something called the President's Cancer Panel Report. It's essentially 2 experts are assigned by a president to do a bunch of investigation into cancer, and they look at different areas with each report. There's new people assigned every few years, and they generate a report and give it directly to the president about, you know, things that may be affecting, you know, Americans' risk of cancer. The one I wrote about was a recent one, I believe it was the 2010 report, and it was about environmental exposure and risk of cancer, because generally speaking, most cancer experts will say, you know, environmental exposure has little to no impact. It's mainly, you know, genetic factors and diet factors and things like that. So things like tobacco and diet being kind of the main pieces, and chemicals and pollutants only causing like 5% has always been the kind of the standard answer. But this report, you know, actually looked at all the data and looked at emerging data and said that that's a vastly underestimated number. They believe it's significantly higher because we have so many chemicals in our, not even just our food supply, but in our environment period that are being shown now to increase risk of cancer. Things like BPA, radon, formaldehyde, benzene, you know, the list actually goes on and on. And it's kind of scary how many of these chemicals are actually not regulated. The way it's set up, which it sounds kind of crazy, is these chemicals only have to be assessed for safety if there's like a question of an issue. They don't have to be assessed for safety prior to being used. So you have all of these commercial chemicals. I think it's like 80,000 chemicals in commercial use in the U.S. and only about 2% have been tested for cancer-causing properties. 2%. I mean, that's a scary number. And the fact that, you know, radon, for example, like 1 in 20 homes have elevated levels of radon, and it causes up to 20,000 lung cancer deaths a year. You know, that's a simple thing we could do or work on to decrease. You can filter your drinking water. There are ways to filter your air as well. Or just get tested just to find out if you have high radon or not. It's a simple way to, you know, certainly decrease your risk of lung cancer. And so things of that nature, you know, things like decreasing plastics. Beyond BPA, there's phthalates. And even beyond phthalates, there was a recent study that showed that even when BPA and phthalate-free plastic, there are other compounds that basically cause mimicking of estrogen in the body. So, you know, they still cause problems that are, you know, there's other compounds that they haven't quite yet named that I'm aware of. Maybe they have, but I'm just not aware of it. But that still are causing problems from plastic. So minimizing plastic in your life, it's impossible to completely eliminate it, and I'm not suggesting that's necessarily the solution because the poison is in the dose. You know, so the amount of your exposure is really a more prevalent issue than just the occasional exposure. But if you can, you know, use stainless steel mugs and use glass or stainless steel Tupperware or, you know, not microwaving plastic, that's a big one. Things of that nature would just be a good, simple preventive measure. You know, it's not going to certainly give you 100% coverage, but it's just one more thing you can do to kind of give yourself control over your, you know, your risk. So, there's a lot more to it than that, but that's just kind of a brief synopsis.
Okay. One more question came in.
Sure.
How does Brian manage being a dad and ensuring he has good nutrition? Does his baby eat baby food, or does he make it?
That is a good question. We had talked about making our own baby food, and we had actually looked into it, but it's definitely time-consuming and not always feasible since we both, you know, are basically working full-time and on top of being a dad and having my online business on top of schooling. That would be a huge, huge challenge. So we actually buy organic, you know, fruits and vegetables, and she's on to a few more things now that come in glass jars. We're avoiding the plastic, and some organic, you know, oatmeal and organic rice cereal that we give her as well. So we don't feed her stuff that we necessarily make her, though I would like to have that happen. It's just certainly not necessarily feasible with our current lifestyle. So, you know, managing being a dad while working full-time, I was taking a class on top of my internship, in addition to, you know, trying to blog and having online clients. It's certainly been a challenge, but it's been a good one, and it's, you know, made me more time efficient and made me, you know, hopefully a better person.
Kids definitely make you more time efficient.
Yes, for sure.
Okay, Brian, we're close to wrapping things up. Any last minute things that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, I think, you know, a piece that people can always take away when I talk or when I write is, you know, nutrition, for the most part, doesn't have to be very complicated. You know, unless you're a bodybuilder or a physique competitor and you're stepping on stage in your underwear, you know, you have to get incredibly, insanely lean. You know, that's not most people's lives. They're not stepping into that situation. They just want to be healthier and leaner and feel good about themselves. And to do that, one of the simplest ways to do it is to focus on one thing. You know, have your diet consist of eating real food. If you focus on eating, you know, real, whole, minimally processed food for the majority of your intake, that's going to do more good things to your performance, your health, and your body composition than any other piece of advice I can give you. So that's the one thing I would really, really look to.
Okay. And where can people get more information about you, Brian?
Sure. They can check me out at BrianSaintPierreTraining.com.
Awesome. Thank you very much for your time, Brian.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much, ExercisesForInjuries.com listeners. Thank you for listening to this interview. A little bit different than the other ones, but I'm finding more and more nutrition are questions that we're going to end up facing from our clients, and it's kind of playing more and more of a role when it relates to injuries, you know, prevention, recovery, and decreasing one's exposure, like we talked about when it comes to cancer. So this is Rick Kasselge from Exercises for Injuries saying take care and bye-bye.